another episode of the Unpublished podcast. My name is Amy.
I'm James.
And today we actually have an in-person interview, which we are so excited about. We have Kitty and Al Tate here. We are both from the same village. We are all creatives making incredible things. And we are so excited to talk to you guys today.
We're thrilled to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It was a long journey to get here. Yeah.
I mean, it was a long journey for us. I think I first went to your bakery when it was a pop-up in Watlington in 2018. And then I didn't go for 4 years. And then when we moved to the village, I was like, I wonder if those bakers are still doing their thing in the village. Actually, that's a lie, because I picked up the book last year when I was in England, and I read it, I think, almost in one sitting. It was so amazing, such an amazing book. Oh, I absolutely loved it. And Amy actually found similarly that she got quite emotional reading the book. She thought,
oh wow, that means a lot to us. It really does. I mean, it's one of those things that you guys probably know, that when you're writing something and you're really close to it, you don't ever really think about other people reading it, and we never did. So for us, we were just telling our story, and it's always strange to think that it's out there now and that other people read it and know it. And yeah, it's a really lovely feeling every time we remember that it is out there.
Yeah, and it impacts people, and it's so generous. Like, I was going over it again yesterday, and I felt really emotional. I'm not sure why. I think it's just this story of like having such a strong creative calling, and having like making something call your name, and having it be such a big part of your healing. I don't know. It really impacted me, and I'm very, very grateful for it.
Oh, that, yeah, like, it really does mean a lot.
Would you guys want to just very quickly go through your story as, you know, as bakers, or even, I think, I mean, Kitty, especially your story. Sorry, Al, I don't want to diminish your role in the story. It must be annoying. What's happened to us?
Well, Kitty, it starts in 1960. Yeah. Yeah. You're here for the long
version.
Yeah, I, yeah, for sure. Yeah,
when
for
I was
sure.
five.
To a very little mother. Yeah. So, I mean, for us, it's even strange being called bakers, because we never really set out to be bakers. We never really set out to have a bakery or a book. I think for the first 4 years, it was more just survival. Mm. So growing up, I'm the youngest of four. Or three. Oh my God, is there an extra chat note?
Is one of the dogs counted in that?
Yeah, dogs included. I was the youngest of three, and you know how you don't mean to, but when you're a kid, you kind of label everyone. And my sister was like the really social one, but also, you know, like struggled a bit with anxiety and stuff like that and needed a bit of help. And my brother was like the really, really clever and academic one, but was maybe a bit shyer. So for me, I felt that I wasn't that academic, but I was very, very happy and easy to please. So I kind of gave myself a label of like being the easy one, like the one no one had to worry about, and who could just like get thrown into any social situation and was just always, always happy. And I loved being that person, but it also was so conditional. And I also felt that like love was slightly conditional around that. Mm. So then when I was 14, I started to really struggle with my mental health. So just became overwhelmed with anxiety and depression. There wasn't a specific reason. It's just was. I think people always want to find out a why when you're struggling. And actually, I still don't really know the why, but it just happened. And I very much didn't want anyone to know, because I wanted to act and I loved performing. So I kind of put on this like shield that I was totally fine and very happy, and I smiled when I was supposed to smile and laughed when I was supposed to laugh and performed to everyone around me that I was totally fine. But I was just exhausted, and acting's exhausting. And like one day I just, this whole like mask I kind of built for myself just shattered, and I couldn't keep going through those motions. And I think that was when Dad and everyone around me realized just how much I was struggling. Mm.
And Al, what was that like as a father when you witnessed that?
It was very difficult. That's a bit of an understatement. There's a classic sort of nice. British. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
it wasn't so good. Yeah, yeah. It was not fine, as opposed to fine. Mm. Yeah. I mean, we were classic sort of dysfunctional family of five. I got my numbers right there.
Well done.
See? Yeah, yeah. With too many animals, too little space, and you sort of muddle on through, and the muddling and the winging had just about sort of worked up until that point. Yeah. And part of that had been because Kitty was the one who bounced into the room and was the sort of one we didn't have to worry about. So we just about stretched to the edge in terms of keeping things going, because Kitty was the sort of, you know, her help, everything sort of tick over. So as soon as she, as she says, you know, her mask just exploded, and everything sort of collapsed for her, and really things just stopped dead. It was that real sort of suddenness, and it came as a total surprise, but it was so real and so visceral.
And then one day you decided to bake some bread.
So, yes, I mean, it was basically we tried everything and anything to give Kitty just some sort of distraction from the sort of dark moments, and nothing worked. So we tried sort of, so whether it's dog walking or telly or craft or knitting.
Oh my God, those who knit, it's like witchcraft. I don't know how they do it.
Do you find it boring?
No, just
how it's like actually really hard. Oh my God, I agree.
I could do like a string and then I was like, don't know how to do jumpers.
Yeah, like I could do this like thin little boy.
Like a little jacket for a mouse. That was my limit after like 6 hours.
A scarf for a mouse.
Yeah, not a jacket. You're not doing
really,
like
that. No. Yeah, keep it really simple. And then the baking was it wasn't even an attempt to try and distract Kitty. It's just something I did and she saw me do. I've baked for ages and ages, but really badly. The whole sort of Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours bit doesn't really
count. Apply to you.
No. I put in Malcolm's all anomaly. That time. But I was still producing terrible sort of breeze blocks. And then I sat on a course by my siblings for my 40th birthday, and I learned how to slop really wet dough over tables and down the back of cabinets. So I was actually banned from baking by my wife.
Incredible.
Because of the mess that I caused. And then I found this amazing method that this American baker had come up with, Jim Leahy, and it's all about it's called no mess bread. And that was the critical
that thing. Was allowed
that was and all you do is you take the smallest amount of yeast, much less yeast than you normally use, and then you take flour and salt and water and you mix it together and it looks like wallpaper paste, and you go, well, that's great, and then you leave it overnight. And the yeast does its magic and just turns this into, well, you describe it really nicely, as sort of like the surface of the moon, basically.
Yeah, so I remember watching Dad make this loaf of bread, and it does not look appetizing when you first make it. Like, you take the flour, the salt, the yeast, and the water, and you mix it into, like, this gloop that looks like wallpaper paste, and it's so grey and gross. And then you leave it, and then in that time just does its magic, and the dough ferments and it turns into this silky, beautiful, like the surface of a moon, dough that is everything that you wish for and that you see in like the videos and magazines, but you haven't had to do any of the work. Time's done it for you. And then you scoop this dough out and you put it in a tin and you bake it. And it makes a beautiful, it's not the sourdough that you see with amazing holes and a glossy crumb. It just makes a really lovely, beautiful tin loaf or a ball if you want it. And it's slightly sweet because it hasn't got the sourdough in it, but it's also got the fermentation still, so it's great for your gut and you're not bloated afterwards. And it's got this lovely, like, deep depth of flavour, but it's so simple. And I think for me, when I watched Dad make it, it kind of just felt a little bit like my brain, like this gloopy, sludgy mess. But actually, with time and with a little bit of patience and a bit of nurturing, it turned into something beautiful. And in that moment, I was like, okay, like, this is what time could do maybe for me. And I think just the process of bread is so magical, how you take four ingredients and you can turn it into something edible. And not just something that you enjoy, but people love bread. And I'm still a people pleaser, and I love that about myself. So being able to produce something which actually wasn't super conditional on who I was myself, or what actually I could do, was brilliant. And I would bake this bread and I'd give it to my family and they loved it, and I'd make more and more and more. And I mean, I was making like seven loaves. I'm quite obsessive, so I was making like seven loaves a week, and we were just selling out we just couldn't eat enough of it, actually. No, we were eating like 99% of our diet was bread, 1% was butter, and we still couldn't do it. So we started like giving it to people, but kind of like leaving it on their doorsteps and then running away and just hoping that they didn't like give it back to us. But people really, really loved it. And like, I was, remember I'd go to the co-op and I'd be like the biscuit aisle, and even though we're just giving it to like friends and neighbors, they were then giving it like slices to other people when they came round. So I was like in the biscuit aisle of the co-op and someone come up to me and be like, are you the one making the bread? And I'd be like, yeah, but we're keeping it on the down low. I'd be like the drug dealer of Watlington.
So then eventually you managed to make this into a whole business. Like, you had a this turned into a bakery. Like, you went from this thing that was once, you know, a loaf a day for 7 days a week into, I mean, I'm sorry, I know I skipped a lot of history here, but it's because I have a lot of good stuff I want to get
we'll
to.
We'll circle back.
Yeah, we can circle back at any time. But then, and now you've been running a bakery for 4 years.
Yeah, it's all part of a very carefully delineated 5-year plan. No, I mean, the whole trajectory was ridiculous. So as Kitty was saying, we started baking more bread than we could eat. We started giving bread away. People started approaching us, and we sort of realized, yeah, just for those moments in the day when Kitty was either making the bread or delivering the bread, it just took you out of yourself, didn't it? Mm. And so for me, I was with Kitty then because I was able to sort of put my work on hold, and so I just went with it. Anything that could give those sort of moments of respite, that we just did. And so we built up a subscription service and just started delivering bread around the village. And then we thought, well, you know, what would happen if we tried to do more? You know, could we do more? Mm. And that led to doing a pop-up, and then the pop-up was extraordinarily successful and did some more. And then at one of the pop-ups, this guy came and sort of said, look, I've got a shop on High Street, the lease has come up for renewal, do you fancy opening a shop? And my every bit of me was just screaming no. No, you know,
what was that, do you think,
saying no?
Yeah, what was that response?
Well, because Kitty was 15, and in my mind, I was just putting things on hold till she was better, and I couldn't see when she was going to get better. But but surely this, opening a shop,
can't be the cure.
No.
Yeah.
Stepping into this whole world of chaos that I had no idea how it would work, that can't be the right thing.
Especially because, Kitty, obviously you love to bake, but there was no guarantee that you would like to run a business as well. And they do seem like very different things, right? Mm. Do you feel like the creativity of running a business was in some way important for you, or...
Yeah, completely. I mean, you're so right. There is this dream of being able to wake up and bake and it'd be so lovely. But that's like 10% of it. Mm. And then the other like 90% is all the paperwork, but also like all the prep, the cleaning, the intro, like all these things, which Dad was brilliant at like picking up. And I think that's why it was so much more of a big thing for you than it was for me. For me at that time, I was so... And I'm so madly in love with like baking and bread. It was just a way that I could do it in a more like secure way and reach more people and give my bread to more people. And I think it just comes to that why. So for me, the why the whole time was just, I wanted everyone to have good bread. I could see what it did for people and it amazed me. And having a shop would get me to do that. So even having a bakery, I don't think I ever dreamt of running a business or having a bakery. That wasn't my why. That was a what, but it wasn't my why. My why was just, how can more people have good bread? So it just ticked every box at that moment for me. But then, so Dad was very strategic and said, well, we can do this, but right now we have £200 from our pop-up and we're going to need a lot more to open a shop. So we went through the costings and we were like, okay, well, we need at least 5,000, probably 10. And unless you can get that money, then we can't do it. So I think Dad was like, yes.
Challenge accepted.
Exactly. I found a loophole. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. And I set up a crowdfund page. So I made a little, I love making stop motion videos.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I take about 2 hours to make like a 2-minute video. But I love it. So like, I move something like tiny millimeter and then take a photo. So I did this video of an orange going from our bakery, which is in our house, rolling all the way up the High Street on like a skateboard, so and then cute. On our dog's backs, and then landing at this shop. And I put it on Instagram, with like a link to our crowdfund page, and within like 24 hours we hit our target. Stop. And at the end of like 48 we doubled it. But it was like people in the village and neighbors, but it was also people from all around the world who were like bakers who were following our story and just loved the idea of it all and were never going to visit but wanted to support it. And I think not only did that like slightly give us, well, obviously it gave us a financial confidence, but just gave us a mental confidence, of course, that like, yeah, we could do this.
I mean, something that's always struck me going to the village was just the line out the door for your baked goods. I mean, it was just an amazing, and it's like this festival atmosphere. Like, there is something about baking really great bread that people absolutely love, and they love it more than, I mean, there's some amazing shops in the village, obviously, like I love the butcher, I love the deli and everything, but there's something about the bakery and bread as a product, do you think is special in the food world?
I think the brilliant thing about bread is it really brings people together, you know, like when you're baking bread, when you're eating bread, it's kind of the centerpiece to a meal, and when it's good, it's really good. And I also think the lovely thing about bakery is it's something that you can eat straight away. When you go to the butcher, you take sausages, but you might cook them up, and at the end of the day they are lovely. Yeah, they're sushi sausages.
Not so good.
Sushi sausages, nah. But then when you go to the granary, again, cheese is lovely, but it's only for a certain type of person. For bread and buns, it's for all ages. It's from like 5-year-olds to 95-year-olds. It's so lovely. It's so nurturing. And I think because it's part of people's daily routine and habit, they really appreciate it. I also think sometimes people just see a queue, especially in the UK, and they're like, oh, I don't know what it's for, but it's a queue, so I'm going to join it.
Yeah. That is something that is very unique about British people, is they love a queue. It's so funny. James couldn't believe it. I'm like, no. And they'll just join it. Doesn't matter what it's for.
Actually, when I was waiting a few times in line, I heard a lot of people walk past and go, oh, there's a big queue there. Should we stand in it? And I'm like, yeah. You don't know what it's for?
It's just part of, yeah, it is part of DNA, basically. Yeah, you know, and also they'll enjoy it and moan about it at the same time. Yes.
And can I say something about England, which I actually think is really sweet, but I struggled with the first month I was here, was in Australia, you order at a cafe or a shop and you are immediately out of there. Like, you're not waiting around. You're actually going to the side for them to pack up all your stuff. Whereas here, if you order a coffee or if you go to the bakery or go to the deli or the butcher, you're standing there and having a chat.
It's lovely.
And I was panicked about it because I'm going, don't you want me out of the way? Like, there are people behind me, but no, everyone's on board with it.
Yeah, it's lovely.
With community.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Okay, so I'm interested in how witnessing this crowdfunding come together, like how did it impact your healing in any way? Did it impact the way that you felt about you? I'm guessing it did. And also for you, Al, like how did it impact you knowing that so many people wanted you to thrive, really?
I mean, on two levels. Like, one, it was incredible to see these people believe in us and what we could do. But it really also just highlights what Instagram was for me, which was, for so many young people, like, Instagram's really hard and everyone's comparing themselves the whole time. But for me, actually, it showed me that there was this world outside my bubble. And there was this world where people spoke different languages to me and were from complete different like cultures and communities, but they were just as passionate about something that I was. And that really made me feel not only supported, but that there was a life and a world beyond my bubble.
That's so beautiful. And what about you, Al?
Yeah, very similarly. I mean, I think one of the things that we'd had when before the shop and during the shop and after the shop has been this sort of amazing way in which bakers have responded to Kitty. So they treated her on a level right from the very, very start, because she had this skill and this enthusiasm. And that was lovely, because it suddenly, it made her feel a part of a community that was much bigger than the very special community where we have here. And I think it's those layers of being accepted and respected and acknowledged really sort of mattered. And the shop has done that as well, time and time again. You know, more and more people who come, we have all the names of all the people who crowdfunded for us up on the wall. And we were still getting people at the end who would walk in and go, oh, that's me. I wish it was incredible. So
you've got your bakery set up, you're running your bakery in Watlington, and then I want to talk about the process of then transforming that journey and your story into a book, because that's not necessarily related in any way to baking. Suddenly you've got to write a book.
I mean, so writing is something that Dad has always been brilliant at and has always done for as long as I can remember. So growing up, you'd always like write our stories and you'd write your own little books. Little books, that's so confusing.
Little books.
Your own little books.
Oh, cute little books.
Cute little books. You write your own brilliant books. So it's something that Dad is already so good at and putting the hours in. And for me, it was just the recipes was a really important part. Like the story I was quite anxious about because going back to a place where I was really nervous. Because I think I felt, fundamentally, I felt a lot of shame over my mental health. That like, I shouldn't have, it's my fault. Not the shame that I had it, but shame of what I did. Mm. Like, I felt ashamed that I couldn't get dressed some mornings. I felt ashamed that like I didn't wash for like 2 weeks. And I felt a lot of shame for everything. And actually like going back and telling the story was really lovely because I really understood that I shouldn't be embarrassed about my mental health anymore. And actually, I really understood what I did and why I did it. Mm. And then the recipes was just so much fun. I had got so much FOMO that I was like, this recipe, this recipe, this recipe.
Oh my God, yeah.
Still have like 100 recipes saved in my drafts.
I feel like I should just quickly explain to those of you who don't know about the book that it, something that's amazing about it is that often I feel like cookbooks will either have not much story at all behind it, or they'll weave the story more into the recipes. And even though you guys do weave stories into the recipes, the first half of the book is your story, which is something that it's a memoir of the two of you, and it's absolutely beautiful. And as Amy and I have already said, it's so touching, and I think it was such a beautiful way to structure it because people really, I mean, they pick up the book and they devote the first half of their reading of it to the story behind the book. And I mean, it just, when I first read it, and as I said earlier in the interview, I tore through it in a day because it was so, so beautiful and so well written as well. Mm. Did you, I mean, obviously Al, you know, you, as Kitty said, you've been writing for a very long time. Kitty, did you find the actual sitting down and typing part of it to be very challenging?
I mean, we did it in a really lovely way. So it was kind of like pen pals. Mm. So what Dad would do is he would write his first like bit of the story and then he would send it to me. And then I would write my part of the story and then he'd read it. And we'd go back and forth. So then we had like all these stories and like my side, Dad's side. And then my mum, who was like our secret weapon.
So the missing element.
Yeah, came in and she just like weaved it all together. So she was like, actually like this part, this is where you come in, this is where you come in, this is where you come in. She was like, we were like the instruments, but she was definitely.
She was a brilliant
the orchestra.
Yeah, so she would cut down my flabby prose and then and work out how things actually fit together.
That's a
hard part. Yeah, absolutely.
But actually, it was all done during the lockdown. So it was this weird thing of like, we wrote our, not the draft, what's the, kind of the draft. And then we had three different company publishing houses like bid for it. And then we chose Bloomsbury, who we really loved. But we never went to Bloomsbury. No one ever really, like, we didn't see anyone. We did it very much. So my mum was our main editor and then we got this local photographer to take all the photos.
Wow. They're such great
photos.
We had
so much freedom.
Mm. Yeah, that's lovely.
But Mark had never done food. He's a wedding photographer.
I love that. Is he local?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck,
so he lives
that.
Just down the road. So,
so cool.
He was happy to go with our ideas and because of lockdown, we just had a bit more control.
I mean, I think that's really beautiful because you got to do it on your own terms.
Yeah, completely. And I think, like, even now when we look back, we're like, wow, we really did do it all on
and
our
even,
own terms.
Yeah, even things like testing the recipes. So if you're normally with cookbooks, you have this intensive time. Someone will go away that you pay for and they will test all the recipes in sort of 2 weeks and check that they all work. And we just had Kitty's godparents, one of whom is a great cook and one of whom is useless.
I still remember the useless one. He's great, he's so lovely, but he made a sweet dough and he was like, the dough just didn't turn out very good. And he shows this picture and he put it in a blender. He thought, oh, it's a blender. So he tried blender and we were like, oh, yeah. Okay.
But it was brilliant because if we knew if he could make things work, then it would work. But we had that freedom. So we were incredibly lucky, I think, looking back.
It sounds amazing. And I mean, the end product is so incredible. And the fact that you two were able to put that together in lockdown, it's just absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm trying to think back to myself, how old would you have been, Kitty? 17, 18?
17.
I mean,
yeah,
I could barely
I
could barely write a 1,000-word essay when I was 17, let alone, you know.
Well, I'm very dyslexic, so I can write quite a lot, but I struggle to read. So once I'd written anything, I was like, well, I can't write.
Can't read it there. I know you're into a podcast. Do you ever listen to audiobooks?
I listen to a lot of audio. So like most of the time I can go through a book a day. I'm really bad. I just binge it. So like even if it's like a 10-hour book, I'll just listen to it solid throughout the day. And then podcasts, I love podcasts, like a whole range of them, obviously your podcast. But then I also love things like How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, is brilliant. And then Off Menu is a great one. So it's a whole, it's,
I just listened to the Stanley Tucci one yesterday of Off Menu. It was so good. It's so funny. Amy was listening, I was listening to it out there. I was doing a little bit of a workout with my dumbbells, and Amy comes out and she's like, and all she can hear is Jane Acaster going, Papa Dom's all bread, Papa Dom's all bread. And she's like, what is happening out there?
So funny. I want to talk about failure. I know this is a conversation we briefly touched upon, Kitty, but I would be interested to hear about how failure has impacted this incredible creative journey for both of you.
Yeah, it's such a good question, because I think there are the obvious failures where you like burnt bread, or we forget, like we put sugar instead of salt into like a batch of dough.
That story stressed me out so much when I read about it in the book.
It is horrendous. Think about it.
I like skipped bits of it. I was like, no.
I can't. And they're like the obvious bits of failure. But I think for me personally was the mental health. So like I very much got better when I was baking, but I got better because I was distracted, not because I'd learned about my mental health. And during the lockdown, we went into the like wartime mentality of like, everyone wants bread, so we got to open 7 days a week. And basically what happens, like we just completely burn out. And the thing that had got me better was now hurting me worse and hurting me. Exactly. The thing that healed me hurt me. And that was really hard, actually, and I had to really learn to understand my mental health, understand what happened and why it happened and what I could do to make it better. And now, like, I really understand it's more of a way you talk to yourself, and it's a way that when that awareness of, there are days where I'm just, like, feeling a bit down, but I have, like, seven different things. Baking's one of them, but, like, seven different things that I can do that make me feel good again.
Yeah.
And that just lift me up. And when I feel down, I know that day I just need to take it easy on myself and not expect to be super productive. But then when I'm feeling good, then I really take the opportunity to be really productive.
So it's
just taking it day by day. But I think that was definitely my biggest failure, was that lockdown where I didn't think about how my mental health was. I only thought of others.
Yeah, I think that something that happens a lot to people pleasing creatives, particularly, especially when your art resonates, and you're like, oh my god, people want this, and I could make people happy by doing this, and then you just go into overdrive because you have to make people happy, and then you burn out. And again, like, that, how painful that the thing that you love and heals you ends up hurting you, and having to sit with that and understand that's so difficult.
Was that part of your decision to step away from the bakery?
So that was actually a couple of years ago. And it was good because it got us out of our home, and we now, like, we renovated an old scout hut in the village, which is amazing. We love being there. Our decision, so recently we've shut our shop itself, but the bakery is carrying on, because we decided that we really wanted to like share the skills of bread baking with others. So we trained up like several local people how to bake, and all of them like complete different ages and never baked before. We train them up, and they've now like running the bakery with us. But our lease came up a couple months ago, and just firstly, just costs are getting so much higher, and we want to make sure that everyone gets paid. So we didn't want to like set them down with a really big lease, and which meant that they couldn't pay themselves. So we're doing Saturday pop-ups, which is what we always loved, and then we might find another premises and just slowly build up. But it also enables us to have time, because for the past 8 months I've been juggling the bakery, which I love, and Dad's been brilliant at like really taking on, because I've also been setting up a charity called Breducation, and I go into like schools and prisons and community groups, and I teach them and I train them how to bake, and I really love it. And I have these little bread kits called Kitty's Kits, which I then donate to these schools and different communities. So I've donated 7,000, 8,000 kits so far. But I've had to do with no budget, like out of my own free time. So it's also like having more time to focus on that.
What's the reaction been when you go in and you go to these places and you teach them how to bake? What is it? How do people respond to that?
I mean, it was really interesting. So when I started, it was brilliant, but it was very much bread focus and just about bread. And then I went to America for a month, and I went to America to a food bank and I taught there, and then I went to like San Francisco and Utah and I did like a little tour, and I was just teaching all these different places, and I really learned the mental health importance. And I don't know, they're just a bit more open there about talking about mental health, but that was far more of a focus and something that even the kids were more interested in. And taking that back now in the UK, so like when I teach the classes, I do it, I talk about like bread and how great bread is, but I also like share my mental health story. And I let them all talk about what helps them with their mental health and what like brings them joy. So like I'm working with a prison in a couple of weeks, and that'll be great, but that'll probably be like, you can talk a bit more openly about it, so you can be like, oh, like what helps you with my mental health. But with little kids who don't understand, I normally just say like, what makes you happy? And the answers are almost identical to the adult answers. It's stuff like being with friends or going for walks or playing or doing some sport of some sort. And it's really lovely. It's always on the same continuum, but it's just raising awareness for them, what makes them happy.
You obviously have such a generous spirit, and you could see it from both of you when you go into the, when you went into the shop, and you know, you have free coffee, you know, you'd be on Saturdays, you go out and you hand,
it's not a good business model,
I know, well, this is the interesting thing is, and you know, you're handing out free baked goods to people waiting in the line. And what do you think is, do you think the generosity always comes back to you in a business like that, or do you think it's, do you think the generosity has helped your business in any way, or do you think it's only been a liability? Or it can be mixed.
Over to you.
I think it's kid, you're saying about business model, we're not great business people.
Do you enjoy it?
The business side.
Yeah.
I think we've really enjoyed making things happen.
Yes. Yeah. I really resonate with
that. And that's been fantastic. So yeah, doing the pop-up recently where we created the pop-up cafe on the top of the hill was brilliant to just sort of realize we can make it happen. So but cool. Also good to know we never want to have a cafe.
Yeah, great. Clarified that.
Absolutely. But I mean, we'll do it again next year, but for that sort of finite period of time, and we'll have learned our lessons. And I think the thing about the bakery was it was becoming too sort of solid in a way. And I think we really need to have options. Yeah. And you know, with Kitty's ideas that she's got, we need to be able to have that space to be able to pivot. Yeah. So I think it's a real mix. I think there is a real creativity in business, and we love the whole idea of seizing an opportunity, but not being tied down.
Yeah, I love that. I think something beautiful about being a creative, and you two are incredibly creative, is we need flexibility because we have so many ideas and there's so much to do and there's so many ways we can impact. And I think a lot of creators make the mistake of building walls around them and their creativity, so they're very static and they have to do one thing over and over again. So I completely resonate with that. Now you have so many options, and because you have so much to give, you don't want to be tied down in that way. And I can imagine that it would have felt quite claustrophobic.
It's the Ralph McTell Streets from London, or Streets of London.
What is this?
There's this comedy program that we always used to watch. Big Train, do you remember the Big Train? And Ralph McTell, who was this amazing sort of singer, but he's only known for Streets of London. And it was a great sketch where it just had Ralph McTell playing Streets of London and everyone just going, yeah, that's fantastic. Oh, I love this song. I love the song. And then Ralph McTell starts playing the next song.
And
everyone starts going, this isn't Streets of London.
This poor guy.
Boo, this. We want Streets of London. And then he has to stop and start playing Streets of London. And yes, Streets of London. And I think we'd reached a Streets of London moment where people were expecting one thing from the bakery. And we've got all these other ideas.
I love that. And the bravery it takes, actually. Like, I've been thinking a lot about pivoting, and I've been speaking to a lot of creatives who want to pivot, and the fear around it is huge because you were successful. Like, you know, you were pleasing people, and your art like delighted, you know, community, and then and knowing that it wasn't serving you in the way you wanted it to, and then making the brave choice to pivot. Like a lot of people won't, because it's just too scary to think about having to let people down in some ways.
Like, you can imagine a sliding doors moment where you just doubled down and you were like, well, I guess we're going to have to just work 7 days a week in the bakery for the rest of our lives. And some people do commit to that choice. And I think it's really brave.
Yeah, something we're definitely looking into. We're like, we could scale up and wholesale and all this stuff. And I think you kind of come back to like, why? I mean, you are tiny on this earth. And like, you're making people happy, but does that matter for you? Like, fundamentally, the whole kind of point of life is to do what makes you happy the whole time. And you're never always going to be happy. But as long as you're always, like, doing what makes you happy, that's the thing to follow. And I think for us, like, as soon as we realize that, like, what we do doesn't genuinely make us happy in the same way, and there's something else that makes us happy, then we have to follow it. That's like a duty almost.
And I think Kitty talked about the sort of the principle that underpinned everything at the very, very beginning, which is just getting good bread out there.
Yeah.
You know, we had a lovely bakery and we loved our customer base, but it was finite. Mm. You know, it was the same 100 faces that we would see every week. And whereas the ideas that Kitty's pursuing now could reach thousands, tens of thousands of people. Yeah. And that is getting good bread out there.
But I think fundamentally it's the same why. It's I want everyone to have good bread.
I love
that. And the bakery was the first, and that was great. But now I need to do something that enables more people.
Yes. So beautiful.
And Al, I feel like something that's interesting about the book is that obviously Kitty is the one who was obsessed with bread, right? And you sometimes feel like you are swept along by this huge tidal wave that is Kitty's. Mm. So what about for you now? Do you feel like you're going to be following along with Kitty? Like, are you still obsessed with the bread mission as well? Like, what are you going to be doing?
The bread tsunami.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good question. I think it's one that we were talking about even this morning, you know, on our sort of walk. The transition for me is that I've had 4 years or 5 years of knowing each day what I'm doing, which is pretty much sort of doing what I can to be there for Kitty. And so that's a nice, easy responsibility to sort of take on, because you don't have to think about it, you just do it. Whereas now Kitty's in such a different place, and her ideas are fantastic. So yeah. I think I'm going to be a sort of wingman for when she needs me with all her different projects. And who knows for me? I don't know.
Would you write more books?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I honestly mean this. You are both, but I mean, Al, you are such a great writer.
Maybe you should write more books. This is absolutely classic unpublished podcast stuff, but that would be wonderful.
More books. Yeah. He has written, he's got like 8 books just sitting there.
Do you? You're like me. I've got 4 novels just sitting there that I haven't really done anything with as well. What do you like to write usually?
It's a total sort of mix, but usually stuff that would lose me friends and family, because it's all about them.
Oh, it's so hard.
So good,
so hard.
Yeah.
So you do a lot of like Kate Atkins style. So it's very much like you'll take like 2 families and see what's like, if they have different children, what their lives are like, basically. Ooh. So like, I think you do really good like slightly like psychological ones that you like really makes you think, and then you also do great stories about like, I don't want to share too much, but like about like the middle class system and the class system in the UK, and just the, like really like humorous too.
Incredible.
So I make Dad read everything to me.
I mean, that's something else about Bread Song is it is incredibly funny as well. I mean, it's got such a big heart and it is hilarious as well. So it gets that amazing mix.
Yeah. But I think there is this, I mean, we talked about principles, but there's this undercurrent of joy in how Kitty approaches bread and bread making, which is again another reason for sort of the shop coming to a natural end, because there's joy elsewhere to be sort of found. And I think I'm really glad that you picked up on that in the book too.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah. So joyful.
I just wanted to very briefly mention maybe my favorite part of the book towards the end of the story section. Sorry, that keeps clattering. Is the metaphor, and I can't remember if it's Kitty mentioning something that Al had said, or if it's Al in one of Al's sections where it's Kitty is the F1 driver and you guys are the pit crew, and Kitty can run herself off the road if she wants, but you guys are really just there to make sure that all the wheels are on properly and all the engines working properly and everything. And I think that's what I feel like with Amy as well. Mm. And I think, to me, that role of being in the pit crew is incredibly rewarding, and I absolutely love it. But sometimes I think maybe you would argue that sometimes I do get caught up a little bit in my role in the pit crew, and you wish I would be the F1 driver sometimes a little bit more. But I do love, I mean, I love my role as pit crew person.
Yeah, and I think there's so much creativity in that role as well. Mm. I guess maybe as someone who has so much drive and so much ambition, and I know we're running out of time, but I was really keen to talk to you about ambition, because I see ambition run through you, and I have a lot of ambition as well. And I think it's an interesting conversation. But as someone who's so driven, I have such a vision, and I just want to go do and make things happen. Mm. And I need James. Like, he is an incredible sport, but sometimes I'm like, we should make something happen for you.
I'm that really annoying, like, even on a walk this morning, did you like feel yourself being annoying? You're like, I should stop talking.
Oh, I know. The other day,
you keep talking.
You do.
So I was like, to Dad, I was like, look, these are like the four things that you could go going. Each one could do like amazing things. This could do this, this could do this. This. And then on the fourth, I was like,
I should have
just stopped on the second.
I really resonate. I've been annoying James the last few days with some talk about nonfiction projects. And then I have my Instagram where I write about creativity. And last night I just did one just for James and I posted it. And I was like, I wrote that about you. And I'm like, I should really chill out. But it is hard, you know, when we have a big creative vision and the people around us, you know, we see a lot. I think we can see the magic in other people too.
And I think personally, like, I'm not saying I'm untalented, but sometimes I'm like, I don't actually have loads as to like what I then do with it. Mm. And I see like others have like so like much like intelligence and like common sense.
Yeah, it's painful
stuff.
To watch.
And I'm like, oh my God,
you could do all this stuff.
Yeah.
I know, like, it's thank taking God me, it's taking everything with. I can not to like harass Al about his books right now.
I know, and I want you to so badly. I'm like, that's a whole other podcast.
Amazing.
I guess we're probably running out of time now. Is there anything you guys would like to say finally? Like anything you'd really love people to know, or anywhere that you'd like to point people towards you?
I think it's less like pointing or whatever, because if you want to Google us, you can Google. I think when you Google us, it comes up with a picture of me and I'm like 13.
Well, we can curate the links picture. At the bottom.
It's an interesting picture. But I think like the main thing to know really is that like you don't have to plan everything out. Like,
oh, if I love that.
Something is bringing you a lot of joy. I have always been someone who's like got like 4-year, 5-year plans, and I always like try and do something because I'm like, well, it should, so it can get to this stage. And actually, I'm really learning at the moment to just do things because I really enjoy it here and now. And if it leads to something cool, but if it doesn't, that doesn't matter because I really enjoyed doing it.
I love that. I think like creatives find the most success and the most joy when they just follow curiosity and what makes them feel delighted. Yeah,
I think you're right, but I think you have to overcome a huge cultural barrier to that. You know, everything is about linear.
Oh yeah, you know, how can you get better and better?
Where are you going? Yes. Mm. Yeah. And can you map it out? Can I see where?
God, yeah. Like, I would have loved to have had a conversation with you about, like, you know, you said no to so many cultural conditions in terms of quitting job and, like, you know, you started a bakery. There's so much to be said there, but I will shut up.
And obviously, a huge pull, you said it multiple times in the books, that everyone's always worried about kiddies' GCSEs, which to me is just like, I mean, obviously, going to school can be important sometimes, but, like, can't you see that something else incredibly important is happening as well?
Mm. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to ask Al quickly, what was one of the biggest lessons you've gotten out of this journey for you, not for Kitty?
For me, I think well, it still involves Kitty.
Okay, fine.
Because
she is a kind of central character to the story.
But it is this the classic male trope is I will fix this with my slightly shoddy toolkit. And that's how I went into things. And I probably, for the first sort of year or so, felt I was fixing things with my toolkit.
Yeah.
And actually, what really fixed things was Kitty finding the tools herself. And that took me realizing I just had to listen a bit more.
Wow.
And not try and sort of, you know, bring in my approach.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. I love that. Thank you so much, guys. It's so nice to have you in our kitchen. We're so grateful to you both. We're so grateful that we get to be in the same village as you and to have eaten your bread. Thank you for bringing us really good bread.
No, we love it. And I mean, how long have we got left? A month, 2 months till you turn celiac?
Oh yeah, we've got don't you, Kitty.
Don't bring it up.
Why'd you bring it up?
Let's go out on a total high. Yeah.
Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.